I thought I would begin quite easily today and let my colleagues and friends like Richard Kleeman and Chris Snyder do all the heavy lifting. What I wanted to do is talk about quantifying uncertainty in the question of extremes and coherent vortices, which is relevant to this workshop. The reason I came up with this particular topic was when this workshop was being planned, I think Andy said, well, you know, if you need a spare speaker, Trivia can talk a little bit on ensembles and stuff like that. And so,
we said anything.
How do I end up getting blamed?
So I took that to heart, basically, since I am in no way a tropical cyclone person. I'm marginally slight moist dynamicist. I never work on the convective side.
But you know
side.
Everything. Come on.
So, please take everything I say with a large grain of salt and CCNs. Okay. All right. So, the outline for this morning will be just talk a little bit about the general problem of uncertainty quantification, and I'm really going to think about it from the operational perspective. I want to get the math people aware of what's going on in the operational centers, how they are approaching the problem of uncertainty quantification. Talk a little bit about the specific problems associated with reliability estimates and predictability estimates of extreme events, okay? That will bring us into the necessity of stochastic physics. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then my sole example relevant to the major topic of this workshop will be a very simple, very old model of hurricane path prediction and show how ensemble techniques can be used in that problem. And also, perhaps, a way in which we can try to use everything that was presented above to help improve the situation in terms of prediction. So that's the broad outline. Stop me at any time for questions. It should be a rather leisurely pace. Okay. So, uncertainty prediction. So, from the National Weather Service or any operational weather service in the world, the problem of weather prediction until about 1990 was treated consistently and uniformly solely as a deterministic problem. They would predict the weather 2 days, 3 days in advance using single model forecast. The only give to probabilistic thinking was in terms of very hard quantities to actually predict using a numerical model, like precipitation. Okay, numerical models still, to this day, find it very difficult to make accurate quantitative precipitation. So things like probability of precipitation, convective events which were not amenable to numerical prediction at that time, were treated as probabilistic forecasts, but all numerical weather forecasts, in fact, were treated as deterministic. Get your best estimate for the initial conditions, integrate forward a numerical weather prediction model, and tell me what the weather is going to be 1 day, 2 day, up to 10 days in advance. Now, after about 1990, the emphasis switched. Part of this was political in the sense that people started thinking of actually doing monthly numerical weather prediction forecasts, seasonal prediction. And because of the very uncertain nature of seasonal prediction and monthly weather prediction, or monthly mean weather prediction, people started thinking in terms of using ensemble techniques, which had been developed, thought of, initiated through some ideas of Chuck Leith as a way of practically implementing something called stochastic dynamic weather prediction, which was a topic of study at the University of Michigan when I was a graduate student. So the techniques that Eric Pitcher and Ed Epstein were looking at were moment techniques, predicting the mean, the covariance, and of course for mean and covariance prediction, if you have an n-dimensional model, covariance prediction is order n squared. So even at that time, forecast models were rather large, maybe 10 to the fifth in dynamical dimension. Current numerical weather prediction models are on the order of 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th. So they're gigantic dynamical systems, if you want to think about it. Getting a single realization is not that difficult on today's supercomputers. You can get a 10-day forecast in about 10 minutes. Idea of...
Excuse me, a 10-day forecast with a single member?
A single member, yeah.
Okay. That's more worth it.
And that's a good number to keep in mind. So at the current operational resolution, that means that if you're going to use an ensemble technique, something like a Monte Carlo technique, predict more than one realization of tomorrow's weather out to 10 days, you're going to be strapped by the number of ensemble members you can possibly use. Okay, it's going to be a reasonably small number, maybe up to 100. 100 as compared to 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th. So it's a gigantic mismatch in the number of degrees of freedom and the amount of probabilistic space that you can span.
How do you count the degrees of freedom? You just do it.
I'm just doing just gross, okay? Computational dimensionality. If you ask dynamic dimensionality, you might come up with a number that's on the order of a few hundred dynamical degrees of freedom. But if you're going to be clever and work in that hundred-dimensional subset, you've got to decide how to reduce the dimensionality of a 10 to the 8th degree of freedom system. All right, so using ensembles, realizations you can get for on the order of 100 ensemble elements, you get probabilistic forecasts with 100 realizations initiated with realistic, in some sense, or representative estimates of the initial conditions. That's the way in which operational uncertainty prediction has evolved and to this day exists. Now, this is just a cartoon of how that works. You have some idea of the uncertainty, perhaps of the temperature at a given time. You run a number of forecasts out for 24 hours. At the end of 24 hours, the distribution that you started with evolves as a discrete ensemble of forecasts. And out of that discrete sample, you try to piece back a PDF at the end. And that's your probabilistic forecast. Okay? All right. Now, I wanted to mention how this mismatch gets taken care of, or at least smoothed over operation. Okay? So, if you're going to do a sample in a 10 million, a billion degree of freedom system, then you have to have some kind of strategy, some kind of intelligent strategy as to how you're going to sample. If you're indiscriminate, just throw random numbers at the system, there's no guarantee you're going to get anything useful. And in fact, that was one of the problems that occurred early on in ensemble prediction. People did not get reasonable results.
What were they doing, Joe? Were they just randomly sampling? Or?
Yeah, well, typically people would just randomly perturb small ensembles, order 10 members, in ways that at least for the most part took care of and took regard of the nature of atmospheric balances. You could envision in this in a system with a million degrees of freedom, about two-thirds of those degrees of freedom are associated with high frequency or higher frequency gravity waves, not particularly of interest in global weather prediction. And because of that, if you just indiscriminately perturb the system, you would perturb a bunch of gravity waves, which wouldn't particularly do much over a 10-day period.
This I'm a little puzzled by. So you have, usually you also have a balancing initialization
right.
procedure.
So
I thought first, once you do a balancing initialization procedure, then you wouldn't have to worry about excitation.
So you have to balance each member of the ensemble. That's what I was trying to get.
Okay.
Okay. Each member has to be balanced. And from that perspective, you reduce the degrees of freedom by two-thirds. Okay. But you still got an enormous number of degrees of freedom. And there were perceived to be problems in what was going on in ensemble predictions just because of the sampling strategy. That may not be as true as it was believed to be in 1990, okay? The reason for that is you're always at the mercy of the accuracy of the tools you're using in this business, and the accuracy of the tools were not very high. So
Joe, can I just come back to something?
Sure.
I think it's an important point. There, you're going to talk about these kind of detailed strategies for constructing
right.
A set of perturbations for the ensemble. On the other hand, you know, the original experiments were just, like you said, basically throwing some kind of spatially correlated noise, but no other structure imposed on it. But there's an intermediate where you're really trying to do a Monte Carlo.
Right. And that might be at least a larger ensemble than what is.
It might be, but I think there's evidence that it actually works pretty well.
Yeah. So I think.
Excuse me, though. Straightforward Monte Carlo after you've balanced the.
Right.
On the balance
set.
Well, you really want to be drawing from the PDF of the analysis, right?
Yeah, okay, in that sense.
That should respect
in that sense.
The
fine.
Dynamical balances. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm going to go through this and then mention some where things stand currently. This is a rather older analysis, but gives you a flavor for how things evolved. So the idea was find a dynamically interesting subspace to do perturbations, okay? A dynamically interesting subspace resulted in the use of bread something called bread vectors by the National Weather Services in the U.S. and singular vectors at ECMWF. And basically, they're both inspired by linear analysis, looking at eigenvectors, not of the dynamical operator itself, but the dynamical operator times its transpose, okay? So propagator times its transpose, positive definite, a symmetric dynamical system. Okay?
So let me ask a technical question, because the inner product is really important. You might have, you use geopotential height, you
right.
use kinetic plus available
okay,
potential
so
energy. What
so
do you use? What's
so
the metric?
In bread vector, let me explain to you the difference between, I'll answer your question first, okay? In bread vectors, it's not going to make much difference. In singular vectors, it makes an enormous amount of difference. And for the operational center that is primarily using singular vectors, that would be total energy, okay? They're using total energy as the norm, okay? That's probably a good norm. It's actually a physical.
I think as a theoretician, that would be my norm of choice.
It's a physical norm.
Yeah.
I've talked with Hamiltonian dynamical systems people who have told me that thinking of entropy as a norm is not a particularly good norm. Okay, potential entropy, it's not really a norm kind of quantity. There's some, yes?
Total energy, does that actually mean that thermodynamic internal energy plus
yes.
kinetic plus potential?
So these are all being done with dry dynamics. So there is the total kinetic plus available potential energy is what is being used.
Okay. Not including the moisture effect.
That's right. Moisture is included in the sense that temperature is virtual temperature in the system, so margin.
John, what's the approximate time scale for linear theory is appropriate?
Okay, so linear theory, the early tests that were done were probably about a couple days. Couple days, and of course, all this depends on how large epsilon is. But as Andy reminds us, if it's not good at epsilon equal 0.1, it's not.
Joe Keller's principle
right.
is 0.25.
Okay, so at some point, because the atmosphere is an unstable system, at least locally in time, then one would see that this asymptotic ordering is going to break down. Yes, Keith.
Can you tell us what a bread vector is?
Yeah, okay. So I mentioned, I said singular vectors and bread vectors are the leading eigenvectors of this operator, okay? And the difference between them, okay? And I'm doing some injustice to a bread vector by saying this, but it's the simplest way I can think of explaining it, is that a singular vector is a vector that will grow very rapidly in time, okay? Will maximize this normed quantity, okay? The growth of energy in the norm, okay? Over a finite period of time. That's what a singular vector is. It's forward in time. A bread vector is actually what has grown the fastest in the past, up to the current time. And they're both local in time vectors, okay? Let me show you, simple-minded idea, example of the difference between the two. Would be if you had this kind of basic state flow, a concentrated jet at one end of this channel, and asked what a singular vector looked like and what a bread vector looked like in this context, this would be a singular vector, okay? And this would be a bread vector. So in this sense, a singular vector looks a lot like an adjoint of an unstable mode, and a bread vector looks like an evolved entity that's almost a normal mode at some point.
Is that the study flow? Or?
That is this flow. It's kind of tricky to think about eigenanalysis in a time-evolving flow. Jürgen Fredrickson has thought about that, but if you can identify something that you think would be like a modal evolution, that would be as close as you can get to the distinction between a bread vector and a singular vector. Okay. There are also a bread vector, something like a local Lyapunov vector, looking forward in time, but for a finite period.
So, Joe, as an outsider, for some reason, I always had this view that the argument was a cultural argument. Except it was the argument between someone who had a big computer and someone who had a small computer. So, it's not that. So,
it's
Joe, as I mean, I also sat through talks where I never understood what they were fighting about. So, but what you've mentioned, so I think of one as being the adjoint backwards in time.
Right.
And so the adjoint backwards in time by the Fredholm alternative is a good one to project on the forcings.
Right.
It's efficient for the forcings
you might anticipate.
That's whereas the other one is trying to anticipate the data itself, not the forcing that might excite those modes.
So another that's exactly
that Fredholm alternative version of what's happened.
That's a slightly different interpretation that I would give, but related, okay? In the sense that if you're thinking in terms of bread vectors, you're thinking, how has the system evolved? What are the likely errors coming into the system at time t equals zero? If you're thinking of a singular vector, you're asking, well, what might be the most dangerous kick I would give the system, okay? And that's precisely what that gives. And so you could have a kick from an initial condition or a forcing that would excite something that looks like this after 2 days, okay? But in order to excite that efficiently, the forcing or the initial condition will have to look like this compacted structure. That's
aren't you really saying, Joe, and this is the way I've always looked at this problem, is that you desire an intersection between, some kind of intersection between the most rapidly growing of errors likely to fall the divergence and the most likely errors that exist in the analysis.
That's right.
The most rapidly growing error has a zero probability of actually occurring in the analysis. You're not going to see it.
Exactly.
You need an intersection of some kind.
Right. And so, in fact, as opportunity and economics would have it, both centers are trying to span each other's spaces these days.
I'm sorry, who uses singular and who uses bread?
European Standard uses singular and NSEP uses
bread. There is a huge cost difference, though, isn't there?
Well, yes. I mean, the way in which singular vectors are computed are actually using the forward and adjoint operator. So it's actually an enormous computational overhead.
The storage coming back.
Right. And very large dimensionality requiring linearization and the complement linearization, so the adjoint linearization of the system. So as with any variational system,
that's why they do
adjoint techniques and singular vectors are an enormous computational overhead that has to be kept up. For bread vectors, they're just growing what the system is growing. So there's no backward forward kind of integration involved at all in this. Okay?
Can I say something?
Sure.
Represent a
lot of people,
so we try to use
ensemble
transform to
one of the.
So what's that?
So
we're dealing with the problem that threat vectors are not unique.
No, what it's revealing is that a cheap computational solution will only get you a couple degrees of freedom.
Yes.
Basically,
yeah.
that's what it's revealing.
So you
got because everything
explore,
is everything
you
is
the phase space, so
everything
you
is collapsing,
yeah.
And one of the reasons why it takes so much computational overhead to do this problem is you're doing it correctly, you're doing it right, you're doing it in orthonormal spaces and all this other stuff, and makes it an enormously computationally expensive.
I guess if I remember correctly, from a mathematical point of view, the threat vector, what they do is just to rescale the thing.
That's
right. So
they take the mismatch between the analysis
right.
and their particular forecast, scale it down, and let it blow up
so
in time. And then that's right. If you have a preferred direction, you're going to see that preferred direction at the ratio of the power in that preferred direction. All right. So it's a kind of synoptic scale, predictability estimates that are gotten out of ensemble prediction. This situation, we're looking at 500 millibar upper level pressure patterns. And we're looking at individual contours predicted by each member of the ensemble. On this side, you have a rather predictable system. The contours are all lining up. On this side, you see that there's some disagreement among the ensemble members with regard to what's going to happen in the 120-hour forecast. And particularly in this region, your guess is as good as anybody's. Now, the reason for doing this was precisely to identify cases in which you don't have much confidence in your forecast. You don't want somebody believing the weather forecast here because basically it's an unpredictable aspect of the flow, right? You can't predict it at this length of time. There's absolutely no consistency. And since you can't predict it, why tell somebody it's going to snow tomorrow if there's at least as much likelihood that it's going to be 75 degrees? And that's the kind of situation that can occur. In fact, that's what occurs in Colorado quite frequently. All right. Now, here's another example. This is a rather long 5-day forecast in which there was a rather severe extratropical cyclone over Scandinavia that was observed. And these are the forecasts. This is the control forecast. So this is the highest resolution forecast the European Center does. And if this were 15, 20 years ago, that would have been the forecast. That would have been it. Okay, a forecaster in the field would have said, it's going to be very pleasant over Northern Europe in the next couple of days. In reality, it turned out to be a rather strong storm, and these members of the ensemble actually represented, to some extent, the probability that there would, in fact, be this. So you can say, not only is the forecast not particularly reliable, but there's a good chance, or there is a chance, that there might be a severe event. This is
this one, Joe, a little bit.
Yeah, I know this one didn't come out as well. I just copied it because it's an interesting event. This is a Lothar storm. This is the storm that blew through France and knocked down everything on Christmas Eve. This is the European Center ensemble for that particular case. And European Center was very proud of the fact that they were able to have members of their ensemble that actually showed a significant weather event at that time. So Rupert mentioned Lothar, like storms, yesterday when he was talking about the multi-scale modeling. And this is the kind of event you'd like to capture. Okay?
Did they have enough confidence to go public before the event?
Well,
that's the bottom line, it seems to be.
Nobody did in that event, first of all. Second, this is, you know, one of the storms of the century. This is going to be an enormously intense storm. That's the verification. There are storms of the millennia on this ensemble, okay? Some of these are extraterrestrial.
Hyper lova.
Yeah. So, again, you know, the danger of predicting extreme events is that you can give people warning, but if your guidance is for a very extreme event and there's a false alarm, or suppose forecast 6 actually verified there's absolutely nothing happening, then you're doing as much disservice as missing the forecast. Okay? In an economic sense, the costs are almost as great, okay?
So you're showing roughly 50 forecasts.
That's right.
And you have, presumably you have, this is the output of 50 forecasts from a leading singular event.
That's right.
So you look at the variance, you maximize the variance. The first one is probably number one, the second one.
So let me tell you the way the European Center actually does it. They only use singular vectors as a subspace within which they're going to do perturbations. So they'll take the first 50 first 25 vectors. And then make random realizations of perturbations using linear combinations of those 25 degrees.
Okay. Changing the sign.
So these are not individual singular vectors for that storm. These are combinations in which each linear combination of singular vectors is gauged to look something like expected initial condition uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. As an aside, Joe, in a situation like this, which is obviously so sensitive to initial conditions, maybe the strategy is to go and tweak the real atmosphere to produce the desired ensemble.
That's right.
Dynamically seeding it with the correct singular. Right?
It would be very interesting to see if, in fact, these are real or memorex. You know, whether it's these are an artifact of model super amplifications that took it into dynamical regimes that never were conceived of in the parameterization, or they could actually occur in the real atmosphere. Yes.
So, Joe, at least if I followed this discussion, which is has some impressionistic aspects to it, you're largely exploring the uncertainty due to initial data.
Right.
Yet if I'm really thinking of modeling a complex system, I would think that uncertainty is due to the model itself, and maybe approximations, discretizations of the model might be at least as large a culprit. Mm-hmm. Certainly the model itself.
We can
should that be part of the... Okay, I'm
not going to say anything. Okay. there you go. The last remnant of Donald Rumsfeld is still here. there's more to the story. Kristen will explain maybe. Anyway, so people have been doing operational ensemble prediction now for 15 years, and what they found out is, in terms of probabilistic predictions, there's some deficiencies. One of the deficiencies is that all ensemble techniques are, in some sense, underdispersive. They underpredict the variations that are observed, okay? And this is one of the verification metrics that's used in ensemble prediction. It's a rank histogram, and it tells you how many times your forecast falls within the observation, the verification, falls within various bins of your forecast. So this is a temperature anomaly. We're looking at 2-day forecast of temperature, and we're looking at the number of times the forecast falls between the lowest interval of temperature and the next interval of temperature in the forecast ensemble. So it's a rank histogram in that sense. Okay, and a very good ensemble prediction system, probabilistic prediction system, would have an almost flat rank histogram. Perfect probabilistic.
Is that temperature at a point?
Right, this is temperature at a point, okay, at 850. And what you see is that this is not a flat curve, okay? And what is distressing about this flatness is the fact that the ends of the histogram are the highest points. Now, the ends of the histogram correspond to times in which the atmosphere, the verification, falls outside the width of the ensemble, okay? There is no ensemble member predicting temperatures here, and greater than here, or less than that point. So the atmosphere is outside the range of the model predictions.
So you characterize that as the model's not dispersive enough.
What?
How do you distinguish between the model not being dispersive enough and the model having bias? Because it would be perfectly dispersive enough
if
it's biased.
Sure, bias. Bias though would be reflected as a shift in this, okay? Okay, and it's
so the asymmetry is biased in that.
Right.
Is that,
that's correct.
How to interpret that?
Now, so this brings us to the necessity of adding some terms which model error. Okay, so traditional reasons for adding terms which model the fact that the model is an imperfect replicate of this physical system that we're trying to predict are precisely the kind of things that Dave mentioned, namely, we've got a finite resolution. And so, because we have finite resolution, there's stuff going on that the model has no way of knowing about, and it's a model error. And since the model has no way of thinking about it, even conceiving about it, unresolved scales are only conditionally dependent, at best, on resolved scales. And so we have a source of error there, okay? If you're thinking that one uncertainty prediction, then actually taking into account all the sources of uncertainty, the fact that the model is imperfect, means that you want to model that and put it into your ensemble system. It also might help with this extrema problem, okay? You're kicking the system a little bit harder. All right, I'm going to skip that. I did want to talk about how stochastic terms, the previous one was to show you that resolution gives you stochastic terms. This is parameterization, convective parameterization. This is something that's a little bit more relevant to the topic of this workshop. And these are scatter diagrams trying to validate parameters within the Arakawa-Schubert convective parameterization. Okay, and what I wanted to show you, actually the best validation comes from the center column, but the best validation has associated with this regression line, which presumably is what's used within the parameterization, plus some scatter around it. And this is perfectly normal, okay? The way we parameterize things like convection, boundary layer, turbulence, etc., is in a manner that says there's a one-to-one relationship, a deterministic relationship between resolved scales and unresolved scales and their input into the tendency. That's absurd. It's only conditionally dependent on what's going on, and that conditional dependence results in not a sharp, straight probability line, but a scatter about the regression line, okay? And
as an aside, Joe, I mean, that you say it's absurd, but in the limit of an infinite sample size, it wouldn't be absurd. It's all about sample size.
Right.
And sample size, in practice, may also mean grid size. So if you have finite resolution,
right.
It becomes more of a stochastic.
That's right. And so, but whatever in convection in particular, it's hard to imagine that Wayne and Accio determined the physical law that actually said how an ensemble of convective elements respond to the large scale environment each and every time you have the same large scale environment. Okay, that's Wayne Smart.
What are you telling our students?
Okay, so
they have a career.
So the European Center, at least, has decided to add stochastic forcing, and one of the ways in which they added stochastic forcing was to say, what is the most uncertain aspect of our model? According to the European Center, it was diabatic terms, okay? All diabatic terms. And so what they did as a method of adding uncertainty associated with model deficiencies was to randomly shake the diabatic terms in the equations. Diabatic tendencies, the heating, moistening associated with convection, radiation in particular.
In fact, they took the whole, if I remember right, they took the whole diabatic vector.
Yeah.
And they adjusted that rather than trying to do it process by process.
It's not process by process, it's bulk tendency, okay? The whole tendency.
But not by a random number in this case? Between zero and what?
Zero and one. It is a random number generator, actually.
But either side.
Uniform between a half and 1.5.
Right. Yeah, that's what it is. Actually.
And is the diabatic also include the subgrid scale momentum or not?
I believe not, actually. Okay. And the reason is it's not a large term. I'm referring to the hyperviscosity. The momentum in terms of gravity wave drag is in fact included in the
units.
Okay?
They only did the known unknowns.
That's right. That's correct.
All
right. So, European Center did this, and it still didn't help their diabetic, their under dispersive. They added random forcing, and
it's not a big surprise because all the events they're trying to model are correlated events.
Well, they do build in some spatial correlation and temporal correlation into that random forcing. And
pretty weakly from what I saw last year at the MCAR workshop.
Right.
So.
Right. Now, what I'm showing here is the error in the deterministic forecast and the spread of the ensemble. And if you're doing a reasonable job, is the error the mean of the forecast and that's the spread. If you're doing a reasonable job, these two should not cross one another, okay? Or they should cross one another very late. It's kind of a, and where they cross and how they cross is the time in which you're saying that the mean error is equivalent to the standard deviation of your own sign. Okay? Once that occurs, basically you have the possibility of the realization or the mean difference between the atmosphere and the forecast being larger than what you're predicting as the variance of your own sign.
So that EECM is the European Center
right.
model, and CMC is the Canadian?
Canadian and NCEP. And so they all suffer from exactly the same problem.
But the cross and the green is at 6 days or five
right.
days.
Right, so I mean, they're doing better. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
They're doing worse.
And that's with stochasticity.
That is with stochasticity, and the Canadians do stochastic
okay.
parameterization by randomly jiggling their constants, their
yeah.
parameters within the parameterizations. Okay, that's how they do it.
Well, you know, this is a comment here. It gets to something Andy says. It strikes me that the forecast centers are going too ad hoc about this.
Yeah.
They
yeah,
don't
yeah.
have a good theory for the amplitude of the stochastic noise. They have no theory for its
right.
self-correlation.
Yeah, this is just
exactly.
a sledgehammer.
It's a sledgehammer, and they're also trying to put a band-aid on what you mentioned, which was that the main problem is the fundamental model error, and they're not going to be able to mask that with the sledgehammer.
Okay.
But they want things that can run quickly and cheaply with the code. That's what it seems what they're doing.
Okay.
Sledgehammer. Yeah.
So, that's bad news for extremes, okay? It's actually a bad news situation for extremes. Stochastic, even with stochastic forcing, the predicted conditional distribution is deficient in the wings, okay? The wings aren't being sampled well enough in the conditional distribution. So, condition on the current state of the atmosphere, that's what the result is, okay? One of the reasons is singular vectors, the way in which the center has done it, they need rather unrepresentative amplitudes. But stochastic forcing can help. Nevertheless, the fact is it also can mask rectifiable problems in the model. Okay? And I put a question there because if I say things are rectifiable, somebody's going to tell me to rectify them. I'm not sure I'm going to do that.
No. Good question, Parker.
Okay.
Couldn't you define, when in the singular vector approach, why couldn't you put in model parameters when you come
yes,
up with
yes,
the singular vector,
know,
and then come up with a combination of model parameters?
Jim Hansen at NRL
yeah.
is doing some of this.
Yeah.
All right, so there's my hurricane picture. That's Elena, in case people don't recognize it. And actually, I put an easier problem.
Floyd. Well, that's Floyd.
Floyd? Sorry. Okay. I can't tell Floyd from Elena. That's really sad. Okay, so one of the reasons I said proper cyclones might be easier is that they're actually, once they're mature, okay, once they're an event, they're actually nice things to think about because they exist. The conditional distribution now has the event in it. It has the extreme event. And the only question is, how might it evolve from that time forward? So in that perspective, I believe it's easier, okay? You can target the ensemble to ask questions about troubles.
Target of SV just means this box where you're
doing
all three of that.
That's right, and so you ask, what is the most sensitive perturbation that would change the forecast in this box that has a tropical cyclone in it, right? So that's at least a targeted question, okay? And that's what makes it easier than random extremes. Okay, so European Center changed the way in which they did that targeting, added new targets, and slightly improved their forecast probability of landfall, okay? That's the kind of track predictions, probabilistic track predictions that come out of this. Okay.
That's 100 realizations.
Yeah. All right, so now for my only venture into tropical cyclones in my life. So I thought it might be useful just to play around with a tropical cyclone track model. And what I used was some of the old work of Kira Kazahara, one of my colleagues, George Horikawa, and Norm Zabriskie and Jimmy Coley was looking at point vortices in the barotropic flow. And this is the point vortex model in the barotropic flow. Okay, it's a simple model. What you do is you evolve the barotropic flow just like you would normally, except when you invent the continuous vorticity, you use the flow velocity of the induced stream function from the continuous velocity plus the singular point vortex. And when you evolve the point vortex, you just advect it with the continuous velocity. Okay, so it's a two-step process. It adds about 10 lines of code to a barotropic model, basically. And all I used was a Bessel function with a radius of deformation.
Yeah, that's the right thing. That's the point for it.
Okay, and so this is my numerical model of the day. So you can see how realistic the point vortices are in terms of stream function as compared to the real world. And this is the kind of evolution that you see in that kind of system. Okay? So one of the reasons I chose this fault. Was that if this were an infinitesimal point vortex, the initial flow was just this hyperbolic spreading flow. It would be a very unpredictable system. Okay, and, depending on what side of the dividing streamline you were on, you would go east or west. With the point vortex actually modulates the flow, so it's strong enough to actually change the flow and actually stabilize the system a bit. Okay. Yes. Okay. I'll move quickly. So I just put this in just to show you how realistic my emotions were compared to the real world. All
right. Oh, is that your model?
Yeah. Right. I wish. So do we all wish, right? Okay, so you can get a track distribution by changing the parameters in the point vortex. Okay? Initial x naught, y naught position, and the initial strength. And these are the kinds of tracks that I was able to generate in that simple point vortex. I'll go quickly. Okay, so the whole point of doing this was to test out an idea I had about variational shadowing. And what I wanted to use was look at the idea of solving this variational problem by using the ensemble of realizations. Okay, as opposed to using the ensemble to define the covariance, I'm just going to use the ensemble to try to solve a fixed variational problem. Okay, and one of the reasons you might want to do this is that it actually tells you what the best trajectory you could possibly have gotten out of the system. Okay. All right, so. So this is the control cost function as a function of x, y, and z, or s, and really I put all the sensitivity is in the x direction. So here's the cost function as a function of x, and you can see that if in fact you chose a proper x, you would automatically get a pretty good forecast out of this, okay, independent of where you were in y and where you were in strength. In this case, so this was a very simple situation in which I developed. This is the two-dimensional function, and this is actually the functional, the cost function as a function of ensemble members. So just ordering it in terms of the ensemble. Now, my idea is there will be talks later. I think Chris is going to talk a little bit about ensemble data simulation, ensemble comma filter. And out of the data simulation system, we'll automatically have an ensemble. Okay? That ensemble will be very useful for ensemble prediction. Okay? It's going to initialize an ensemble for ensemble prediction, and the ensemble will be representative of the real estimated uncertainty that we have in the simulation scheme. Okay? Now, the question or the problem then is, what is a good trajectory in this system? None of the ensemble members are necessarily a good trajectory. How do we get a good trajectory? I'm going to pose that as the variation problem. I'm almost done. Okay. So, to me, that is the big problem, okay? And I'd love to talk with any people with more mathematical skills than I have with regard to how to couch that in the realistic setting. In the point vortex setting, it's an easy problem to solve. What I wanted to show you today was the current methods of ensemble techniques offer you a method of uncertainty prediction. They can be tailored for extrema, but the extremes must exist, okay? They're not very good at generating extremes. Stochastic terms are needed to inflate ensemble variance in these techniques. Shadowing can be useful for two reasons. One, you find out a lot about the discrimination between model error and initial condition error if we know what the best trajectory would be in the system, okay? So this is why one might want to do smoothing and shadowing, is to actually find out what the optimal forecast you could have possibly made and actually fit observations over a period of time. If you can't make a very good prediction, then you know your model is deficient in some fashion. Okay? It is not working the way it ought to work, and that's a huge clue in terms of rectifying problems. And in particular,
isn't that a little bit strong? I mean, it could be that the dynamical system itself makes the prediction impossible. In other words, suppose I gave you a copy of the world, but just didn't tell you the right initial data,
right,
a copy of the universe, you might not be able to predict the weather.
But if I could find a very good trajectory, whether I'm using that trajectory at a particular time, a posteriori, I could find it,
yeah,
a very good trajectory, I could know that the errors that I witnessed in a particular prediction were not due to deficiencies in my model, or largely due to deficiencies in my model. And that's the point, okay? All right. The ensemble techniques can be used to solve variational problems with regard to this shadowing. Really interested in how to generalize this for the actual problem of a small ensemble and a large dimensional system, where the geometry, the dimensionality, is being specified by the ensemble itself. This is a tricky problem in geometry. We've tried looking at this by fitting quadratics in five-dimensional spaces and things like that to try to find the minimum within the ensemble. There's got to be a better way of doing that, but I just don't know what it is. And that's it.